Elena Ferrante with the ball. The scrappy Italian point guard doesn't use her real name. She's guarded by Anthony Doerr. Ferrante picks up the dribble, takes it to the 10. Yes! Those who leave and those who stay. She left, and Doerr stayed way behind. For Anthony Doerr, that was all the drive you cannot see. Now it's Marlon James with the ball. Jamaican novelist out of the University of West Indies, guarded by Evie Wilde. Pulls up for the 18-footer. Yes! Marlon James is teaching a brief history of seven facials here today. And now let's go courtside, where Kyone Tafoya is talking with Jesse Ball. Kyone?
Jesse, you're a poet and a novelist. Your book, The Silence Once Begun, is matched up with Phil Klee's Redeployment. How much is this National Book Award on your mind?
Well, Kyone, I just have to play my game, which I try to stay within myself. In the scheme of things, it's not about me. It's about literature. After all, there's no I in The Silence Once Begun.
Actually, there's one I in Silence.
I'll take your word for it. I don't keep track of statistics.
How big was it in the first round when the Department of Speculation crushed Annihilation?
It was big, Kyle.
Yes, but how big?
It was just big.
You people drive me crazy. You're writers. But whenever I interview you guys, you have nothing to say.
I like to leave it all on the page, is all.
Well, Marv, that about wraps it up from here. I'm going to throw it to the nose, where they'll be analyzing this tournament of books. And now he can't believe the drubbing Goodnight Moon gave 50 Shades of Grey, Colin McEnroe.
And the worst part was that 50 Shades of Grey kept saying harder. All right, so we are going to talk about this remarkable thing called the Tournament of Books. And that I feel as though before I even do that, I feel like I need like a sports fanfare. Do we have a sports fanfare? Play me a sports fanfare so I can kind of get in the mood. That's what I'm talking about. Yes, it's the News' live coverage, advanced coverage of the Morning News' Tournament of Books. This is a tournament which pits 16 pieces of fiction published in the previous year in a bracket-style formation. There will be four semifinalists who will go to the big dance. One of them will emerge with the rooster, the big trophy from the 2015 Morning News Tournament of Books. I feel much better now. All right, so we're doing sort of an unusual version of The Nose today, a very special edition of The Nose. And we have three super readers here in studio who've been plowing madly through these 16 books, although for one of, I think one of them actually finished early. But and in fact, I'll introduce him first, because if it turns out that as a result of how this show goes, there's blame to be apportioned, I think Alex Dubin should get some of it. Alex Dubin is a writer who frequently complains to me that this show spends way too much time talking about television and not enough time talking about books. So I made him read 16 books. But you finished early, right? You finished...
Well, I had read about half of them before we ever started this.
Yeah, so you just coasted. Yeah, it was just kick-push for you. You Lupe fiascoed that. All right. Also with us, I guarantee you that we will never, ever... do a show about brackets that does not involve Julia Pastel, no matter what kind of brackets they are. I mean,
remember birds? Wow, that was,
right.
Years ago.
We did do a bird a bracketology show that was all birds against one another, and Julia also participates in our annual March Madness bracketology show. She's known for her work at the Mark Twain House, her leadership of CT Improv, her hosting of a podcast about books. What's that called again?
Literary Disco.
Literary Disco, and also known, of course, for her brief unsettling marriage to Thomas Pynchon.
Yes.
And Rand Richards Cooper is with us. He's a novelist, essayist, and short story writer. He still cannot believe it's not butter. But here to explain this, because I have not explained this well at all, which is kind of a specialty of mine.
Even to us.
Yeah, even to you. That's right. I've explained nothing well to anybody. But joining us now is Kevin Guilfoyle. He is the commissioner, the old man of the tournament. We should say this tournament is the 11th time the Morning News has sponsored or hosted the Tournament of Books. So, Kevin, first of all, just in a very sort of thumbnail fashion, tell us what happens in this tournament.
Well, each year we pick 16 books from, as you said, novels that were published in the previous year, in this case 2014. And they're not necessarily what we consider to be the best books of the year. I think that would be absolute folly to try to pick out of the 100,000 or so books that are published. And we're making, in fact, this tournament was conceived as a way to sort of make fun of any attempt to try to any book award to go behind into a conference room and emerge with a single book and say, this is the best book of the year and everyone should read it. We were all kind of fascinated by book awards and loved the way that when books make news, there is discussion about literature. It's maybe the only time that there's discussion about literature in our country is when books make news. And we were actually talking about this one day, and to borrow a phrase from Justice Ginsburg, we probably were not 100% sober. I suggested, strictly as a joke, that we should take 16 of the most hyped books from the previous year, throw them into a bracket, seed it like you do the NCAA basketball tournament, and then in the first round, pick 8 judges, each of them read 2 books, and advance one of them. But more than that, they would have to describe in detail why they chose one book over the other. And they would also have to disclose any connections they had with any of the authors. And then that would bring us down to 8 books in the mm-hmm. second round. And there would be 4 new judges. Each would read 2 books, advance one, and so on until we had a champion book of the year. And then we would threaten that author with the presentation of a live rooster.
And the rooster is the symbol of this whole thing. But you omitted one structural aspect of the tournament, which is the zombie round. I don't know if anybody else does the zombie round, but explain how the zombie round works.
Right. Well, before the tournament starts, we ask readers of the Morning News to look at the short list of 16 books and vote on their favorite book of those 16. And then once the winner's bracket gets down to 2, the presumptive finalists, we take the 2 books that have already been eliminated that received the most votes, and they come back from the dead, as we call them, the zombies. And the presumptive finalists must battle past these 2 zombies to make the final round.
So this is really interesting. And so you may even know right now who the zombies are as commissioner of this tournament. You may know, or somebody knows, right, who the zombies are. But these zombies will not rise until really, you know, what we would consider the final 4 of the tournament, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So that makes it very exciting. It's kind of like, you know, the judging, nobody's ever really dead until everybody's dead. So one of the questions that I have as we go along here is about this notion of books not competing against one another and really being, you know, put almost Michael Vick style, you know, into pits where they battle one another. And so, Rand, recently, I think, heard an interview I did with Steve Allman, the author and advice columnist, who was sort of against all contests that involved judging art and pitting art against one another. Did that make you at all uncomfortable as you went through these brackets, as you read these books and thought of them in this highly competitive way?
Well, you know, Colin, I'm very uncompetitive, and I also would be very reluctant to issue any sort of judgment about the relative merits of works of art. So, yeah, it was quite daunting. No, seriously, though, of course, the one of the great things about competitive team sport is that the whistle blows, the game's over, and while you may gainsay strategy, the result is what it is. It's not a subjective thing, you know, unless it's ice skating and you have the East German judge. But we all understand that, and this is interesting to me, that one encounters a book with one's whole history as a person, as a reader. There's the act of reading a book is a communication between you, the person behind the page, and the magic through which the words are arranged on the page. There's anything but objective clarity in that. So when each one of us says something about a book, we're saying something about ourselves in relation to the book, and that makes it a whole different tournament.
But actually, you know, necessarily that's the case, right, Julia? I mean, I think one thing Kevin said to us in his many admonishing emails was that that it's, you know, it's complicated to answer the question, did I like this book?
Sure.
But it's easier to answer the question, did I like this book better than I like that book? Were you pretty comfortable with that?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with it. I mean, one thing that I was thinking about coming into this was this is different than a traditional bracket because it's saying, you know, it's not saying, hey, Marlon James and David Mitchell, you're going to go up against each other, write a book with that in mind. You know, the book, the game's already played.
Strangely, the authors did not know they were going to be in this tournament.
Right. But I think that when you put two books against each other, you really have to confront your own prejudices. And I think there's a lot of that in here. And I mean that in ways that I'm, you know, readers can be really snotty about. Like, I don't like books about Brooklyn, or I don't like books written in dialect.
Stop stealing all of Alex's lines.
But I think that there's a lot of judgments we make like that about genre, and to confront that and ask yourself about length or how much you're willing to be challenged is exciting and it's fun. That being said, I think some of these matchups were either really close or really unfair to one book. So it was a great exercise for me and really a great way to keep up with all of the cool books from last year, most of which I hadn't even heard of.
Before I turn to Alex, I just want to mention you're free to call in with your questions or comments. 860-275-7266. We'll actually tell you the titles of some of the books, I promise, fairly soon. 860-275-7266. You may tweet at our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, at WNPR Colin. So, Alex, Julia says that, you know, this is inevitably a subjective, inevitably just a reflection of one's own personhood. You don't believe that, right? I mean, some of these books are just platonically and objectively better than some of these other books.
What? I'm hesitating, but yes. Yes, I do believe
it's
that.
It's a trap. It's a trap.
And for the record, Julia, I said contemporary accounts of middle-class white people living in Brooklyn. Those are the novels I loathe.
Yeah, you loathe those? And what's the other kind of novel that you loathe?
The other genre I loathe are post-apocalyptic novels.
Of which we have several.
Yeah.
Yes, many.
I mean, they're sort of – they're. I feel like when I was growing up, I really loved post-apocalyptic novels because they didn't drop all that often, you know? I mean, you didn't get them all that. And there's like so many of them now. I feel like one of the things that our generation and perhaps several generations after us, after mine, has done is actually ruin the apocalypse. I mean, we've actually overexposed the extinction of humanity to a point where now it's like a Will Forte television show. Sorry, Alex. Like 82 novels every year that are post-apocalyptic in nature. Kevin, how much attention do you pay to genre as you guys are laying out this bracket? Do you try not to think about it, or do you feel like, wow, we should definitely have one cli-fi choice on? How about the Vandermeer novel? Do you care about genre?
I mean, I think it's impossible not to think about it, because that is the way books are marketed to all of us all the time. And I think that is sometimes problematic, and it's an ongoing theme of the Tournament of Books. The discussion around the Tournament of Books is how much should that matter. But, yeah, we certainly do think about it. I actually, you know, I write books that are classified usually as thrillers or literary thrillers. So I love those kinds of books as well. I love science fiction. I love mystery. I love all kinds of literature. But I think the problem, the thing that concerns me about genre, and one of the things that we try to kind of attack in the Tournament of Books, is when it's one thing when publishers put books in a box and say, you know, this is a mystery or this is a science fiction novel. But what eventually happens, unfortunately, and I think Julie alluded to this earlier, is that readers start to put themselves in a box after a while. And they say, well, I don't like science fiction books. I don't like mysteries, or I only read, you know, romance or whatever. And I think that is bad for everybody. And so we do try to bring books in here that I think might be branded as, you know, like Annihilation, which is pretty much a straight science fiction novel.
It's considered cli-fi.
I would say it's horror. That's so interesting.
Well, all right, but yeah. But it does overlap. It's a speculative fiction anyway, and I think that there's a lot of people who would never pick it up. But in my opinion, it's just a good book. It's a really good book, and I think that one of the things we really want people we hope people will do is break down the walls of those boxes a little bit and start reading outside.
And I just want to compliment you and everyone who put this together, because after I'd read all the books, I was kind of taken aback by how diverse a selection it was, not only of genre, but of, you know, gender representations, races, and actually, this is a really nerdy thing, but publishing houses. I mean, almost all of these books are from a different imprint, which is really cool because that represents a lot of different voices and styles.
By the way, I just like saying cli-fi. Like I know what I'm talking about. I mean, I also like saying eco-fabulism, which is another genre that's sometimes directed at Jeff Vandermeer. All right, so I feel like we're talking at the level of abstraction, and we should be talking a little
bit
more.
Let's go to the brackets.
Let's go to the brackets. So I think what might be fun for the listeners, assuming that any listeners that are finding any of this fun, but I know they are, is if we were to take a couple of sample matchups and just talk to our panel here about, you know, how you're dealing with them. And so there's a couple of fairly controversial matchups in the first round. We can talk as we go along here about some of the books that maybe some of our panelists don't even think should be here and all that. But there's a couple of instances where books that are very strong. And so here in what we would consider to be the Northwest corner of the bracket, we've got a 2 seed against a 3 seed, A Brief History of Seven Killings, that's by Marlon James, All the Birds Singing by Evie Wilde. We should say that Evie Wilde was added under a process which, after Kevin and his other secretive band of hooded figures are all done figuring out the draw, then they get one book that's kind of a wild card that's recommended by independent booksellers who say this is the book that we at the cash register, we just recommend to people because it was just, you know, our favorite book from last year. That's how this book got into the draw. But so handicap this one for us, Rand Cooper.
Well, it's a great first-round matchup. The Marlon James book, A Brief History of Seven Killings, comes swaggering into the bracket with making a lot of noise. It's a big book. It's got a contrapuntal narrative with many different voices, fractured narrative. It takes place mostly in Jamaica of the 1970s. It's an attempt to account for the unusual level of violence, including political violence in Jamaica in the 1970s, and it uses the attempted assassination of Bob Marley in December 1976 as the centerpiece of the novel. It's 700 pages long. Much of it is written in patois. It's a hard book to read for a bunch of reasons that we can talk about. It's a violent, it's explicitly a book about a world drenched in violence. It's loud, and it's very impactful. All the Birds Singing sneaks into the bracket very quietly, and it is a quiet book about quietness, written by an Australian novelist, Evie Wilde, who lives in England. And it's a book with a very meticulous use of prose and a very interesting and intricate narrative architecture that we can discuss. So that's the overview of the two.
All right. So, Alex, as you looked at this particular matchup, did you just know right away who you were sending on to the second round?
Well, I had read Marlon James last year, long before this, and the book blew me away because it is an incredible book. It goes from 1976 in December, around the time of this attempted assassination, and it goes into the early 90s. It involves the CIA. It involves drug running. It involves gangs. It is not brief. There are far more than seven killings. But it is an incredible, incredible book. In a way, I don't even know that we have enough time to go into. But I loved that book so much. And the Evie Wilde book, which just won, was named by Barnes & Noble as one of their great new writers. As a former bookseller, I can very definitely understand the passion for this book, because it is just a beautiful, very quiet, understated kind of book.
And I think also this gets into that whole question of sort of relative merits and stuff like that. Julia, I can also understand as a bookseller that you'd be very comfortable recommending
yes.
this book to somebody. They're not going to come back and say, what the hell kind of book did you just have me read? Whereas maybe with the Marlon James,
totally.
700 pages of patois later, you'd be back at the cash register going, are you
I
crazy?
Think the difference between what I love and what I recommend is often very different. And people ask me for book recommendations all the time, as I'm sure happens with you guys. And always my first question is, well, what do you like? Not because I want to recommend something that's similar, but because I don't want to ruin my reputation as a recommender by putting something crazy out there. That being said, for me, this was a really difficult matchup for me. But on my personal preference, I like a really challenging book with a lot of different narrative language styles in it. So I gave it to Brief History of Seven Killings, but I zombied All the Birds Singing later.
Okay. I love how you already mastered the patois of this tournament as well. So Kevin, one thing that I noticed in like some of the comments to some of the introductory pieces that Morning News has done, commenters saying that one of the solutions that they had to A Brief History of Seven Killings was to listen to it rather than read it. And a number of people said that that's actually sort of a better way to go and maybe take some of the challenge away. And do you have – I mean, Julia brought this up, I think, in one of her emails, the whole question of what counts as reading, you know, and is an audiobook the same thing? Do you particularly care as a commissioner?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm not really an audiobook person myself. I prefer to hold a book in my hands. But I absolutely think listening to a book is reading it. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
All right. We're heading towards our first break, and we've actually taken care of actually one matchup.
But I didn't evaluate my
But you want to – who are you taking to the second round?
Although I'm going to lose, I'm going to take All the Birds Singing. Let me just try to say one evaluative thing about each book. Marlon James' book, History of Seven Killings, is a great test book for an issue that we discussed in our emails, and that is how much difficulty is a contemporary reader willing to put up with. Now, Marlon James' book is difficult really for me, in three ways. One, the political, historical, and cultural grid of 70s Jamaica is a little bit unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. Two, It's written in a fractured way with lots of different voices covering many years, so you have to sort of put together a narrative. Three, it's written largely in patois, and some of the patois is of people who are like high on cocaine and hallucinating. So every time you try to read more quickly through this book, you absolutely cannot. There's a Joycean quality to the novel that at the same time you admire it, but like I was trying to finish these 16 books. I had to slow down or else I realized I did not understand that page. The sweep and ambition of this thing are huge. The Evie Wilde book, by the way, we didn't even describe what it is. Mm. It's set on a lonely sheep farm on an island off the coast of England. A woman who's probably in her late youth or to early middle ages, somewhere in her 30s, is a lonely sheep farmer there, and she seems to live a life of stolid obscurity, and we don't quite know why. A predator of unknown source is carrying off her sheep, and that mystery is carried forward. At the same time, in alternating chapters, we go back 15 years to her earlier life as a teenager in Australia when she was on the road running away, working as a roustabout sheep farmer, running away from something calamitous that happened to her. Those chapters move backwards in time as the top story moves forwards in time. So it's really a story about victimization, menace, and memory. And it's one of these books where you feel like every word is controlled to create a certain mood of ominous menace. And I think I found really the meticulous moodiness of that near perfect, whereas Mike Marlon James' book was amazing to me. It was all over the place. It was like an enormous fireworks display.
All right. I love that, All the Birds Singing. It is an easy-to-recommend book anyway. All right, so we're going to take a quick break here. I got to manage the clock better than I've been doing so far. We'll be back after this. All right, so we're back. We're talking about the Morning News Tournament of Books. You can go on our website, WNPR.org, go to the Colin McEnroe Show, and get more information about it. Download your bracket. I should quickly say also, you sort of got time, even if you haven't read very much, because you know the tournament really doesn't start. The games don't really start, so to speak, until I think – is it Monday, Kevin Guilfoyle? Is the
correct,
first one?
Correct.
Yeah.
Monday.
So
they go all month.
Yeah, they go all
the
month.
Tournament lasts a little month.
You're probably not going to – I mean, I think the Marlon James book comes up on the second day, so you're probably not going to read that in time. But but some of the other books you can read pretty fast, and you can get into the swim if you're interested in this. So anyway, it's the Morning News Tournament of Books. We're going through the brackets with our panel of super readers, Rand Richards Cooper and Alex Dubin and Julia Pistel. So, you know, we'll do some of the tight matchups in the first round. But we should also talk about sort of one that many of our our panelists here saw as kind of lopsided. So in the first round, we've got in the upper part of the northwest corner, the Bone Clocks up against Adam. And Kevin, I know that you as commissioner don't really want to say very much about these matchups or how you see them or anything like that. I think one thing that you can say if you read your own comments is there was a fair amount of pushback about the inclusion of this book, Adam, by Ariel Schlag, by some of your readers. Did you notice that?
Well, I mean, part of it, again, goes to kind of genre issues. I mean, I think there were some, some people look at that book and see it as a YA book, even though it covers some fairly controversial territory, at least controversial at this point in 2015. Adam is about a teenager who goes to visit his older sister in New York and pretends to be a transgender. He's a straight man who pretends to be a transgender man, born female, in order to impress a girl who is lesbian. And so it's a book with a lot of adult themes, but it has sort of walked this line between YA and adult fiction. And as a result, I think a lot of people don't really take it all that seriously in some corners.
Yeah. I mean,
when you compare it to a book like The Bone Clocks, a big book by David Mitchell, it might look like a mismatch.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I kind of liked Adam, and I found it a very enjoyable, readable, engaging book. I don't really associate it with greatness. And so, Julia, you know, as a frequent basketball commentator,
yes,
that, you know, occasionally in the first round, you've got what they sometimes call a cupcake team, you know, that's just it's like a goat staked out for the Tyrannosaurus in Jurassic Park. And you're just going to watch the Tyrannosaurus eat the goat.
So sad. Yes, I know. I thought this was a really weird matchup. And I know there's disagreement on this panel, but I also really liked Adam. And what I felt about it when I saw the matchup is like, this is just
poor
so hopeless.
Adam.
Because humor, what I liked about it was two things. One, big humor submission. And two, it's the main relationship in it really is the sibling relationship, which is pretty unusual given like all the other books are about love and violence and everything. So it was great to see a contemporary look at siblings and sex. But, you know, it's like the Oscars. Something funny is never going to win. There is no way that's going to happen.
It's why Jerry Lewis feels only French people understand him. So,
can I just comment on that real quick?
Yeah.
I mean, normally books like that don't do very well, I'll be honest. But in one of the, I think it was the second year, Sam Lipsight's Homeland, which would be a book that very much in that category, like Wittgenstein Jr., made it all the way to the finals.
Great.
So it's not there is a path in which these kind of books just charm judges all the way.
Yeah. Well, as we say, that's why they play the games. Alex, I think this would be probably one of your examples of something that is platonically, objectively decidable without recourse to one's own subjective feelings. Particularly because it involves middle-class white people in Brooklyn, one of your bete noirs, right?
But I did like Adam. I mean, and I've met Ariel Schrag, and I know her work as a cartoonist for many years. I mean, it's this very intense, visceral novel about what it means to be an adolescent.
And a kind of a loser, too. That's one of the things that I liked about it. I mean, it really, you know, she really gets the voice of a loser.
She really gets the voice. And I don't know how she got this teenage boy voice, but it's incredible. And I related to it. It was really intense. Having said that, I'm a huge David Mitchell fan. I've been a huge David Mitchell fan pretty much since I read Ghost Written like 15 years ago or whatever. And I think The Bone Clocks is perhaps my favorite David Mitchell novel thus far.
Yeah.
And it just blew – I mean Bone Clocks blew me away coming in with big expectations. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would kind of blow away almost every book in this tournament.
All right. So he's tipping his hand a little bit here. And Rand, my sense is you saw things pretty much the same way as Alex.
Yeah. What was the metaphor? The Tyrannosaurus Rex and the goat?
Yeah.
Well, I think the Rex should eat the goat and does and, you know, should slurp it down very quickly with as little noise as possible. Actually, perhaps it's interesting that the issue of the category of Adam, is it YA or is it adult fiction, actually does matter a great deal to me. I wasn't thinking about that at all. And partway through the book, I felt, okay, the adults have been ritually and completely banished from this world, and we desperately need some sort of other character's point of view to create some kind of, you know, narrative tension between the main deal and something else. One of the problems of the book is that the sensibility of Adam and his friends, which is superficial, sarcastic, and obsessed with appearances and casually insulting and often mean-spirited, is for very much of the novel sort of the center of the novel's own sensibility. Then there's this about-face at the end, and Adam is used as a vehicle for sort of all sorts of like progressive lessons in transgender diplomacy, which seemed ham-handed to me and just not a serious adult novel. So I pretty much totally dismissed it. I also, by the way, thought it was odd, and I noticed that on Goodreads a number of transgender and gay readers sort of beat up on this writer for, I mean, the lesson of the, he poses as a trans man to win this girl that he loves, and he's straight, and so he's teasing, he's duping her the whole time, and the moral of, well, in the end, he finally, as it were, springs it on her that he is anatomically male, and sort of the lesson, and she accepts
it. Spoilers, spoilers.
Well, okay. Oh, no spoilers. Anyway, so
that is such a spoiler.
That's I didn't know it was supposed to do spoilers, but the Mitchell book, and I hadn't read Mitchell before, so this is my first book of his. I found it fascinating, and Julie and I were saying off air. I had, for me, a unique experience in this book. I resisted a lot of it at the beginning, and sort of the identifying feature of it is that it seems like a very familiar realist domestic novel of recent decades, and very carefully, bit by bit, and done in a very artful way, he begins to titrate in another dimension of complete mm-hmm. unreality. And he does it very, very adroitly. And I found myself at first resisting, because I'm a kind of reader who favors, by and large, with some exceptions, realist fiction. And then by the middle of it, you know, he had totally won me over. And then the last quarter of this novel, essentially where the totality of the otherworldly reality behind what we've been seeing is laid bare, and these two mythic forces of good and evil really set to battle, I like hurled the book across the room and yeah. no longer had any interest in it whatsoever. And I the only thing I could think of was the old TV, cult TV show of the 60s, The Prisoner, which I watched with great fascination when I was a little kid. Patrick McGoohan is kidnapped and trapped in this strange world. And as long as they kept the secrets of this world hidden from me, I absolutely loved it. And then finally, when they were forced to sort of reveal what was happening behind the scenes, I loathed it and I just wanted to shut it off. And I felt the same way about this book.
Rand probably didn't even watch Lost. So
it's a similar experience. Yeah. Mitchell is so adroit. The best thing about his books, and I've only read this in Cloud Atlas, but they're very similar, which I actually think takes away from your enjoyment. The more Mitchell you read, the more you're like, oh, this is your bag of tricks. But he's incredible at creating voices and going through these different historical and geographical.
Oh, he can do anything.
He can do anything. Yeah. So I think a lot of, and I love it, but for me, it's a lot. I know a lot of people come away from him saying, but why? You know, like, what is this really about? Well, it's about this like giant metaphysical game. And, you know, that's fine. It's always about reincarnation with him. And that's cool. It's just, it's a entertaining work kind of posing as a more serious work. But a lot of people love that.
Well, there's a great winking moment. There's a great winking moment in the novel when he sort of clues us into the problematic that he's addressed. And one of his narrators, each the sections are narrated by different characters whose lives intersect.
You're not going to give away something
no.
else.
No. But one of his narrators is this really tedious, snarky novelist named Crispin Hershey. And I think there's a colloquy between him and he's desperately proposing some book just off the cuff because he needs money. And his agency says to him, you know, you can't do that. You can't have a book that is half realistic and half fantastic. You know, either a woman is pregnant or she's not.
Wink, wink, wink.
And so there, you know, many of these books I noticed, there are ways in which the author finds some way to let you know exactly what she or he is addressing by way of a problem. This is exactly the problem that Mitchell's taken on in the book.
You know, Kevin, one thing that you told us in getting us ready for this show, which you did so admirably, is that one of the patterns of past tournaments, and I may not be expressing, or I might be rephrasing this wrong, but some of the sort of real sort of ambitious tour de force books would do well over the first couple of rounds, but then ultimately not go all the way. I mean, I'm sure you can express that a little bit better than I just did.
Yeah, I mean, there's often when we have a big book in this tournament, say a Pinchon or a Bolaño, often the book is so ambitious and just such a monster that it almost has a force of its own, and the early judges just sort of pass it on even if they don't like it, because it's almost like they just don't know what. it must be great because I don't get it, and they just pass it on. And other people love it, and they advance it. And so those kinds of books tend to do very well in the early rounds. And at some point, it's difficult. You've got to string together four or five wins in a row. You've got to hit a sweet spot with a large number of people to win the tournament of books. And those books rarely win in the end. They usually fall off somewhere around or just before the zombie round.
Alex, I know you had one question about this, and I think a lot of our panelists raised questions about sort of structural questions. One of the 16 books' redeployment is a collection of short stories. Two of the books are parts of series. So, Alex, you had some questions about that, about how do you evaluate things under those circumstances?
Well, yeah, I think it's especially difficult because, redeployment, as you said, is a collection of short stories. It's very good. But at the same time, we're judging a collection differently than we would a novel. Mm-hmm. A short story, pretty much in any short story collection, there's a few really good ones, a few that are okay, a few we like less. But when you read a novel, you may have sections that are very good, sections you don't like, sections that may cause one to throw the book across the room. But how they coalesce is key. And in a short story collection, they don't have to. Mm-hmm. And then for a series, for example, one of the books is Those Who Leave and Those Who Stay by Alana Ferrante, which is the third book in her Neapolitan novel series. It is an incredible book. The entire series is just – I love this series. Alana Ferrante is – I had not read until we did this. Mm-hmm. I read her the three books in the course of a week, less than a week, I think. She has literally become, in the course of February – one of my favorite new writers. But at the same time, Julie, you read just the third one. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, a series is different. I think putting in the middle of a series is rough going. But in terms of, short stories against a novel, I think that's fair because, readers are making that judgment when they walk into a bookstore. And if we say, hey, redeployment, which I think is fantastic, is better than half these novels that you're going to see everywhere – that's great. That's great for this tournament and for us to be pushing forward short stories or any other, kind of genre. And, when you have a David Mitchell book in there, that's basically short stories, right? There's one little plot going.
Alex is getting madder and madder.
Now I'm just being incendiary. But I think they do hang together, and it is fair to put short stories in with novels.
Reading the Elena Ferrante book, just the third of the series, were you able to understand why Frodo was trying to destroy the ring? That was
the Ferrante book is great for a lot of reasons, and one is the language, and it's, this beautifully translated, European style where everything's explained, there's lots of details, and there's also about 30 pages of explanation of who all the people are before you read a prose sentence. So it's a great book. It made me want to read the rest of the books, which is, the highest compliment I can give it.
All right, we have to take another break here. I'm telling you, clock management is a problem here. This is our Tournament of Books episode of The Nose. We'll come back after this.
Remember that on Sunday you have to turn your bone clocks ahead. And I say this without really knowing what a bone clock is. Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Sydney Lauro and Kelsey Bissell. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by the Bronte sisters. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff playing a shirts and skins game against Mary and Carol Higgins Clark, visit our website WNPR.org. On Monday's show, we'll mop up the messes from the weekend. And now, back to Colin.
And this is our special Nose, in which we're breaking down a tournament of literary fiction, bracket-style, a March Madness-style tournament of literary fiction that's run by the Morning News. It's great fun. It gives people a chance to argue. And so joining us is the commissioner of that tournament, novelist Kevin Guilfoyle. And then in studio, we have super readers, Julia Pastel, Alex Dubin, and Rand Cooper. And I thought what we would do, just so we don't run out of time here, is have each of the panelists talk about what they see in their dreams as the final game, the final matchup in this tournament, the two books that they'd like to see fighting it out for dominance at the end, one of them being lucky enough to step forward and have Kevin Guilfoyle hand it a rooster with a tiara. So, Rando, how does that play out for you?
Well, my final four were Station 11, which is a futurist dystopian novel, Redeployment, the Iraq War Stories, which we talked about, and then my two favorites in my final four were All the Birds Singing, which we discussed at length, and finally, All the Light We Cannot See, a much-praised book by Anthony Doerr, D-O-E-R-R. And it has to do with – it's a long book. It has to do with World War II. And it's told, it's made, and this is kind of interesting, of almost exclusively very short chapters, 5 pages or less. It's a little bit unusual that a novel of such sweeping historical scope, it covers many decades, would be built. It's like a big edifice built out of really small bricks. And I wondered about that at first, and I was a little bit skeptical of it, but I think it worked very well. There are two main point of view characters. One is a teenage French girl named Marie-Laure, who's blind, and she lives partly in Paris and partly in the coastal city of Saint-Malo, which underwent a terrible bombing in the D-Day invasion. The other is a German private in the German Wehrmacht named Werner Pfennig, who is a radio specialist, and their two lives intersect in ways that are both – it would be a spoiler to tell it, but it's a way too elaborate to figure it out. Now, what I love about this novel – I'll say two things about it. First of all, it has this very big historical sweep, and it's full of social history and military history as well. That's very impressive, the hoard of sort of historical reality he's gotten onto the page without it being obtrusive in any way. But it pays minute attention to the inner worlds, particularly of young people. It's a very, very lyrically written book. He said something interesting about it, asked about those short chapters. He said, well, since I'm writing in a way that's more lyrical than perhaps 75% of American readers are generally willing to accept, I decided to leave a lot of white spaces. And so that's sort of an interesting compositional reality of it. If you like books that combine a sense of the passage of time, love and the loss of love, and, you know, you're willing to be sort of moved. This is a very emotionally moving book, and it has a crescendoing and even borderline sentimental orchestration of events at the end. If you don't like that kind of thing, you're going to resist this book. But if you do, and you are like the sort of you like a smart book that is also emotionally profoundly moving, this is your book.
All right. Just saying the title only, Who Gets the Rooster?
Like the perfect small book or the big...
Just the title.
All the Light We Cannot See.
Push the button. All right. So Julia Pistel. Before I go to Julia, quickly, Kevin, I do want to say that as this tournament goes along, you and your confederate, John Warner, who's been on this show earlier to talk about this, and I think a couple of other commentators, you guys are going to be sort of reporting on the judges' decisions, and then there will be some commentary about those decisions, right?
Right, there's a lot of layers of meta commentary involved. There's the judgment by the particular judge, and then John and I weigh in as sort of booth commentators to comment on the judgment, and then there are the readers, the audience basically, who comes in and comments in the comment section. And that really is the reason for this existing, is this big discussion about these books that comes up all around it.
All right. So, Julia, walk us through the big dance.
Sure. Well, I did want to say, you know, I took this really seriously, probably too seriously, and I made myself write down what I was actually judging when I judge a book. I think it's important to reveal my criteria. So here they are. First of all, I like a book to feel like a scuba dive, you know, like a new reality, a new way to breathe, really pulling you in. Does the structure tell the story in a way that brings out the meaning, or does it obscure it annoyingly? Can I feel the author? Is it a Pinocchio, or is it like a real boy? And finally, will this book haunt me forever, and will I think about it in 5 years? So with all those criteria, there's so many good books in here, but my final four were All the Light We Cannot See, Brief History of Seven Killings, which we already talked about, Department of Speculation, which, while being a Brooklyn-y novel, it has some just great writing in it that will haunt me. And but my number one was a book that really surprised me. I'd never heard of it. No idea what it's about. Silence Once Begun. It's this weird, weird book about a man who loses a bet and signs a confession to a crime and goes through a trial without speaking. And it's absolutely fascinatingly weird. And I just thought the structure was strange. The characters were strange. And it's the kind of book that I know that I'm going to remember a long time from now. So I really highly recommend. And that's the one I think I'm going to recommend to a lot of people. So I took that all the way home.
Silence Once Begun, all the way. Gets the rooster. All right, Alex, your turn.
Okay, my final four would have to be The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell, which we've already talked about. All the Light We Cannot See, which I think Rand described wonderfully. I mean, it's epic, but it's also this very intimate story of these two people in a way that only a novel can really do. Department of Speculation, which I will second as just a great, great book.
It Breaking is, your own rule. Wow.
It is about white people
we
in
Brooklyn.
We thought
you were dissing that book.
I
loved this book to a degree I was not prepared for, truthfully. It was a joy to read. I mean, this is a book that's under 200 pages.
I mean, you really can. It's almost advertised as like a cup of soup or something. I think it says on the cover you can read this in one sitting.
You can read this in one sitting. It is laugh out loud funny. There are moments of I think, really great profundity. This character just sees the world from such a weird vantage point. And I love weird vantage points that force you to rethink how you're seeing the world. And that really did that. And then the fourth one would have to be Elena Ferrante's Those Who Leave and Those Who Stay.
And then break it down for us. How does it all play out? Come on. Make some choices. It's Sophie time here.
I know
it's,
what he's going
it's
with.
Sophie time.
This
David Mitchell.
Show.
I love David Mitchell. I'm freely admitting my bias. But yes, David Mitchell, who won the first tournament of books, it should be noted.
So Kevin Guilfoyle, as you listen to this conversation, is it similar to the kinds of conversations that take place around you as commissioner? I mean, do you thrill to hearing these three people who've worked so hard to reason this whole thing out?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly what, you know, the point of this tournament, as I said before, is not to – it's not – this is not a prescription. We're not saying, hey, these are the books you should all be reading. What we're really saying is let's use this mechanism as a way to just start the biggest conversation about not just these books, but why we read. You know, when you're asked, do you like this book? The answer to that is actually kind of a fairly abstract question because, as Rand was saying before, these are just emotional. Your reaction to a book is emotional. I like it or I don't like it. But when you're asked, do you like this book more than you like this other book? That's actually more concrete. Question. And it's in some ways it's easier to talk about. And again, as Rand said, what you are actually talking about isn't so much these books after a while. You're talking about why it is you read and what kind of reader you are. And that to me is much more interesting than a book review.
Yeah, Rand.
One thing I noticed just beyond the particular books, sort of talking about the space that reading takes in our life and what we're able to give it to it. I, unlike Alex, had only read one of these books beforehand, so it was sort of a crash course. And partly I was doing this to kickstart my habit of reading literary fiction, partly as penance, and just to know what the various noises are being made out there. But one thing I reminded myself of is that, you know, whatever our cultural priorities are and pastimes and habits, watching movies, TV shows, there is a particular experience that a book you have completely fallen into affords. And we were talking about this before the show. No matter how much I might like watching a TV show, it's almost never the case that during the day I'm thinking, can I please get rid of the rest of this day so that I can watch that TV show? But that's exactly what happens when you're in one of these novels. That becomes, for a time, your real world. And this thing that you're living, this ghost world, is something you just want to hurry through so you can get back in. So part of this process for me was a sort of...
was alienating your family. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. And making my wife blow the snow.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, Julia. But one thing that I would sort of say, I loved all your criteria that you had. Mm-hmm. One that has dawned on me over the course of this discussion is that I might even add to your list is, do I miss this world when it's gone?
Yes.
And you know, when Rand was talking about All the Light We Cannot See, I was really, I had this moment, this kind of heart-tugging moment of, wow, It's been 3 weeks or so since I read that book, and I feel like he's talking about people that I really, really miss.
There are a handful, and I still think about them from childhood all the way to, you know, this week of books where, you know, I cried because it was over. And, you know, that's such a special experience. And I feel like for people who really love books, every time you read a book, you're looking for that.
And people are now crying because they know the nose is over. The show is over. They're going to miss Kevin Guilfoyle and Alex Dubin and Julia Pistel and Rand Cooper. Thanks very much. We'll be back on Monday.
Congratulations. Any words for your fans?
I'd like to thank God and the author of all the literature that's been most influential to me, including The City of God, The God Delusion, The God Particle, Their Eyes Were Watching God, Waiting for Godot, and, of course, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.